important that we review and do so timely, so that we'll remember the things that are in the chapters in Hebrews. I think it's profitable when you're studying the book to be able to go back through the things and say, now, what chapter was that in? And be able to recall those things from our study. As the writer presents the Christ as better, he begins in the first chapter by showing that he's better than what? Better than the prophets, that's right. And continuing in the first chapter, better than angels. And then as we turn over to the second chapter, we see the thought continues that he's better than angels. But then as we come to the third chapter, he's better than Moses. And then as we come into the fourth chapter, we see the comparison made to enter into the rest that the Israelites did not. And then as we come into the latter part of the fourth chapter, we're introduced to Jesus as the high priest. And we want to remember verses 14 through 16 specifically, because in these verses it says, having then a great high priest who hath passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we have not a high priest that cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but one that hath been tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. Let us draw near with boldness unto the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help us in time of need. Notice, if you will, in these verses, the significance not only of the fact that we have a high priest, present tense, but also the need that we can approach God. We can draw near unto him through this high priest. Now, what is it that prevents, or I should say, what is it that prevented those Jews in times past from being able to draw nigh unto God? Now think carefully. Pardon me? All right, the animal sacrifices served a purpose, but the animal sacrifice, I'm going to lead your thought here just a little, didn't prevent them from drawing near to God, but it served a purpose of bringing to their mind sin. That's right. That old law could not forgive sin, and so those animal sacrifices provided them with a consciousness of sins. Now, that old system could not make perfect in the sense of cleansing the conscience, and the defiled conscience made it difficult, well, it made it impossible for them to draw nigh unto God. Even the high priest himself had to offer a sacrifice for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. And so that all is discussed in the 7th and 8th chapters. But as we look at the interim between the 7th and the latter part of the 4th chapter, what's being discussed? The 5th and 6th chapters primarily. Okay? No, there's a parenthesis, if we may call it, in there that identifies the people as being immature. They've not grown as they should. Now, at the conclusion of the 6th chapter, he comes back again to this priesthood, the priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. But if you'll notice, Judy, I think you're looking at the first part of chapter 5, and you're correct. But at the last part of chapter 5, beginning at verse 11, we see this beginning of a parenthesis, as it were, interrupting the thought of the priesthood to talk about the immaturity of the Hebrews, as they have difficulty talking about the priesthood because of their state of immaturity. And he rebukes them, and rebukes them severely, and points out that by reason of time you ought to be teachers. And then in the 6th chapter, the early verses of the 6th chapter, he points out how that they are to press on from the things that they have espoused as fundamentals, and press on unto perfection, as Paul stated it in Philippians chapter 3, beginning at verse 13. So these are thoughts that I want you to remember and be aware of as we continue our study, to see the continuity of the thought that flows through the book of Hebrews. Now, there's a word that appears over and over in the book of Hebrews, in fact about 12 times, that becomes a theme of this book. What is that word? Better. Very good. Better. And as we study from the 9th chapter, the writer is talking about those things that pertain to that Old Testament system. He talks about the Old Testament tabernacle and the things that pertain to that Old Testament tabernacle and the significance then of those things under this new order. And if you'll notice in Hebrews chapter 9, I want to pick up the reading at verse 11 and pick up our discussion about verse 18. But in verse 11 it says, "But Christ, having come a high priest of the good things to come, through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, nor yet through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, entered in once for all unto the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling them, have been defiled, them that have been defiled, sanctify unto the cleanness of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish unto God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" Let me pause there and notice a couple of things in this in passing. Number one is in verse 12, where he entered in once for all. That's going to become a theme that occupies the next couple of chapters. How that he entered in once for all. You'll see that repeated in the ninth chapter at verses 26 and 27. "But now once at the end of the ages hath he been manifested to put away sin." Verse 27, "Inasmuch as it is appointed unto men once to die, and after this cometh judgment, so Christ also, having been once offered, to bear the sins." Yes, Joey?
I'm impressed by this phrase "for all." Just a very small little phrase there.
Yes. That's right. That's the doctrine.
Christ did not enter just for some elect, chosen group.
That's right.
He says he entered for all.
That's right.
Not all will take advantage of his work and what he has done. That's true. The scriptures tell us that many people will be lost. But he died and entered into that heavenly place for all.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. To offer his blood there before the Father as a sacrifice. That's right. Hebrews, 2:10 says that he tasted death for every man. Very significant that we see that, not just pass over it. So that's right. But this idea of once is repeated over and over. If you'll drop down into the 10th chapter, verse 10, it says, "By which will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all." There it is again, Joey. And you'll also notice in the 12th verse and the 14th verse, "But he, when he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God." Verse 14, "For by one offering he hath perfected forever them that are sanctified." The idea of this once is significant. David, and then back to Joey.
By saying once for all, means it's completed, it's finished, and
that's right. It's over and it's done, and he sat down at the right hand of God. It's over and done. No more offering, as we'll see in the 10th chapter. Joey?
Question.
Hebrews 2:10, I believe it is.
I looked there. Hebrews 2:10.
Yeah, it's not 2:10. 2:9. I missed it a verse. Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. 2:9. All right.
Get with the program there.
I started at 10 and read it on. No, it's not anywhere.
Yeah, 2:9. 2:9. Sorry about that.
Thanks.
You bet.
I just wanted to know where it was, but that's such a key verse.
You just wanted to test me to see if I knew where it was, didn't you? Yeah, I was waiting for that. All right. Going back to Hebrews chapter 9, let's drop down to verse 14. "How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish unto God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" We've talked about the significance of the blood of Christ cleansing the conscience. It was the problem with the conscience that man had that kept him from being able to draw nigh unto God. And then if you'll notice in verse 15, "And for this cause he is the mediator of a new covenant, that a death having taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that run to the first covenant, they that have been called may receive the promise for the eternal inheritance." We talked about the importance of the blood of Christ for those that lived under the law, how that the blood of Christ, we use the expression, flowed back to cover them that continually offered the sacrifices and faithfully offered the sacrifices under that Old Testament system. And then at verse 16, for where a testament is, there must of necessity be the death of him that made it. For a testament is a force where there hath been death, for it doth never avail while he that made it liveth. We've talked about a will or a covenant or a testament, as the word is used in this passage. And we've noted that it is never of effect as long as the one who made it still lives. We understand that analogy today. I think we did in our last class, talked about being the executor of a will and how that you only have authority after the person who made it dies. You can't execute the thing until it becomes effective, and what makes it effective is the death of the testator. Yes, Joey?
we see the value, this may sound like a trite statement, a trivial statement, but we see the value in trusting in God here. Because verse 15 says that the death of Christ would cover the transgressions of the first covenant. So put yourself back in the first covenant where you see this rolling over year to year, where you have to, temporarily, if you will, not permanently, but, roll over these sins. And I can only assume that the people at the time were probably perhaps confused or not understanding how total remission would ever come, because they're living under a law where they're not seeing total remission of sins. And yet, the people that were faithful to God, even though many of them perhaps even died not fully understanding how total remission of sins would ever happen, we see that by trusting in God and obeying him under that law, that an event that would happen thousands of years later, that they knew nothing about perhaps, would ultimately end up removing their sins, as explained here in verse 15.
That's right.
So the people in the old law, I'm sure a lot of them had no clear understanding of how total remission of sins would ever occur, yet by blindly trusting in God, they will receive that total remission of sins because of what Christ would do in the future.
That's right. I don't want to completely take us off thought, but that's an important thought, which is developed by the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 1, and points out that even many of the Old Testament prophets who revealed bits and pieces and details about the development of that system did not understand that which they pointed unto.
Is that the same passage that talks about things that even angels discern?
That's correct. That's correct. David? Okay.
Okay, but in the New Testament, covenant means a last will and testament and stuff. It's kind of interesting because in the Old Testament, they thought of it more, not a will, but as the contract.
Mm-hmm.
And then what Jesus had quoted from the Septuagint and other, matters quoted from the Septuagint. And by that time, it comes in Greek and Latin means last will and testament. So it's
kind of becomes the same.
The thought of it. It actually changed too, because in the Old Testament they actually thought of it more of the legal contract or contract with God. You be my people, I'll be your God. And stuff.
Okay.
That test of last will, but then Jesus used that, and the apostles used that, because the Old Testament was not effect once the word.
All right, Ken, and then Peggy.
Maybe you could help me out on this one. I was always under the impression that although the prophets gave little pieces, that God gave them little pieces here and there as it went along, I was under the impression that through Abraham he knew that there was going to be a promise, and there would be salvation in that promise. Was that not passed on? Even though the prophets might not have known how it was, the angels didn't know how it was, they were always intent about finding out what was going to be done, but they knew it was going to be done, right?
I'm not sure to answer your question. I know that Abraham was given the promise in Genesis chapter 12. It was repeated to his son Isaac and then to one of his sons, Jacob. And I know that Joseph had an understanding somewhat of it because of the comments that he makes relative to the land promise and the significance of the promises that God made unto Abraham. But as far as just how detailed that was, I don't know, Ken. I don't know whether they had a full understanding of the coming of the Savior. Now, Isaiah evidently did because he prophesied of it in Isaiah chapter 53. David evidently had some understanding of it because he's the one that wrote in Psalms 110, the whole chapter there that prophesied the priesthood of Christ. But as to what detail or what amount of knowledge they had, I don't really know. I'm not sure there's a way to find out, to be honest. But some of them had some understanding of the coming of the Messiah, or else we wouldn't have the prophets to tell us about it. But just how much they knew, I don't know. I don't know. Bruce?
I was just going to mention Isaiah 53, you know, just like you mentioned. You know, something to look forward to. But, you know, it kind of, when you look at the book of Malachi, you know, it just seemed like they just forgot about it.
Yeah. Well, by that point in time, they were indifferent towards spiritual things. That's true. Peggy?
Well, I was really going to think it was just a small observation about last wills and testaments, in the sense that once the testator has died, there's no changing the provisions of the will.
Right. That's right. It's locked in at that point. Yeah.
That's it.
Not going to be any more. Roy?
Jeremiah 31:31 touches on a little bit.
All right, it talks about the giving of a new covenant, the ending of the old covenant. That's right. And the terms and consequences of the new covenant, how that it would be different from the old covenant, a different kind of covenant, and the provisions of remission of sins that would be provided. That's right. And, of course, that, as you said, comes from Jeremiah. So that was what, about 700 years or so before the coming of Christ.
The understanding of Israel, Israel and the Holy, they have a very poor understanding.
Well, I think that's true. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I saw a hand. Okay, David?
That when Christ died, it seems so final there, verse 15 and verse 16 of the Testament. Also necessity be the death of the testator. And also verse 17. And it seems like the blood of Christ is the very seal that sealed everything. In other words, there's not going to be any more of this. And because it talks about being better and better and better in the sacrifices. And he was the perfect sacrifice without sin. So in response to those who might believe in Calvinism and a society or something on earth again, these to me are the verses that point out that now this is once for all time here.
Well, that's right, and that's stated a few times in this combination of the 9th and the 10th chapters. And then when we come down to the 10th chapter regarding the man who commits willful sin, there remaineth no more sacrifice. This is it. The last sacrifice has been offered. There's not going to be any more sacrifices, plural. Only one sacrifice offered for all time. And that's right. Not going to be any more. Now, in reference, Ken, to your question, you've asked me an intriguing question. In the Ephesian letter, in the 3rd chapter, we notice beginning at verse 10, Ephesians 3, verse 10, it says, to the intent that now unto the principalities and the powers in the heavenly places might be made known through the church the manifold wisdom of God, according to the eternal purpose which he purposed in Christ Jesus our Lord. This dispensation of salvation in Christ, the combining of Jews and Gentiles in one body, is the context being discussed here, I think was a marvel even to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. Certainly they didn't understand all the details that were involved in redemption through Christ. And this passage has always amazed me in that light, to note that even principalities and powers, those who were in the presence of God, didn't understand the fullness of the plan of God until it was made known. Terry?
About Ken's question,
Okay, let's turn to it. 56 through 58. Okay, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. That does answer what Abraham knew. Yeah, Abraham looked forward to the coming of Christ. Okay. Does that help, Ken? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. 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 All right. Well, let's go back to the text of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 9. Let's pick up the reading at verse 18. It says, "Wherefore even the first covenant hath not been dedicated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses unto all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and the goats and the water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded to youward." Now let's pause. Well, verse 21, let's get that one. "Moreover, the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry he sprinkled in like manner with blood." Now in these verses we see reference made, I believe, to Exodus chapter 24, verses 1 through verse 8, regarding the sacrifice that was, procedure that was gone through to dedicate that old covenant. Now, in these verses we see some detail, although we don't see all the details that the Hebrew writer states here. Exodus includes portions that are omitted by the Hebrew letter, and the book of Hebrews includes portions that were omitted by Exodus. The hyssop was usually attached to the cedar wood by means of a scarlet band. Then the scarlet wool attached to the hyssop to absorb the blood and the water for the purpose of sprinkling. Now, after the commandments of the Lord were recorded, this text tells us that Moses read them to the people and then ratified that covenant by means of blood. The people of Israel then became a peculiar people because of this procedure that Moses went through to dedicate or consecrate the covenant upon them. Now in verses 18 through verse 21, it's just a statement of fact that Moses did this. Now, there's a time element involved in this, I think, that we need to mention in our study. In verse 21, it says, "Moreover, the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry he sprinkled in like manner with blood." Now think of the time element when the law was given and when the tabernacle was built. When the law was given, was there a tabernacle? No, there wasn't. Pardon me? The tent came later. That's right. And so I think that it's very likely that this occurred at the consecration of Aaron and his sons as they were consecrated with both oil and blood. The law mentions nothing about the consecration in particular of the tabernacle. However, we've got this statement by the Hebrew writer and a statement given by Josephus that I think is an interesting statement. I want to read it to you. It says, "When Moses had sprinkled Aaron's vestments, himself and his sons, with the blood of the beasts that were slain, and had purified them with spring water and ointment, they became God's priest. After this manner did he consecrate them and their garments for 7 days together. The same did he to the tabernacle and the vessels that thereto belonging, both with oil and first incense, as I said, and with blood of bulls and rams slain day by day, one according to its kind." Now when Josephus makes that statement, he's talking about the consecration not only of the people, but also of the tabernacle itself. So couple that with what we have here in the book of Hebrews, and it becomes evident that not only did the people receive the sprinkling of the water and blood, but also the vessels of the tabernacle likewise received this consecration. Now, for whatever purpose that serves in our study, there it is. But what we know is that the tabernacle and the people were consecrated. Now, in verse 22, that little expression "almost" is important to our study. It says, and according to the law, I may say, or I may almost say, all things are cleansed with blood, and apart from the shedding of blood, there is no remission. What exceptions were there that is implied in this little word, almost? Can you tell me any exceptions that you may be thinking of? Almost, I say, all things are cleansed with blood, and apart from the shedding of blood, there is no remission. In some cases, there was purification made by water. We can read about that in Leviticus chapter 16. Pure water was used for certain purposes. And sometimes purification was made by fire and water, as we read in Numbers chapter 31, beginning at verse 22. But I think the apparent exception is seen in Leviticus chapter 5, and I want to take a moment and turn back to that. Leviticus chapter 5. Did I see a hand? Okay, I think so. Leviticus chapter 5, let's read beginning at verse 11. As it's speaking of the law of sin offerings, it says, but if his means suffice not for two turtle doves or two young pigeons, then he shall bring his oblation for that wherein he has sinned, the tenth part of an ephah of fine flour for a sin offering. He shall put no oil upon it, neither shall he put any frankincense thereon, for it is the sin offering, or a sin offering. And he shall bring it to the priest, and the priest shall take his handful of it as a memorial thereof, and burn it on the altar upon the offerings of Jehovah made by fire. It is a sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him as touching his sin, that he has sinned in any of these things, and he shall be forgiven. And the remnant shall be the priest as the meal offering. Now I read that because this, I think, becomes an apparent exception to those who were too poor to bring two turtle doves and two young pigeons to sacrifice, as they were required to do, are now required to bring a tenth part of an ephah of fine flour, which the priest would burn as a memorial upon the altar. Even so, we see this to be an exception to the rule, but it was an exception to the rule pronounced upon those who were too poor to offer a blood offering. Okay?
So it was a grain offering.
It was a grain offering, yeah. Let's go back, if you will, now to our text. Pick up the reading at verse 23. In verse 23, it was necessary, therefore, that the copies of the things in the heavens should be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. Now, this particular verse introduces something that can be a little tricky or a little difficult, I think, to explain. But the better sacrifices, certainly required by the better system, the blood of Christ himself is a better sacrifice. But what are these heavenly things that are discussed that need to be cleansed with better sacrifices? Everybody sure is quiet tonight. Pardon me? Okay, our conscience needs to be cleansed in order for us to appear before God's throne. Now that's the desire, to draw near unto God. But in order to be able to do that, the conscience has to be cleared, has to be cleansed. And in order for the conscience to be cleansed, what had to take place? Had to have a better sacrifice. The blood of animals couldn't do the job. And so I think the thought expressed here is right, Ken, meaning that as men on earth could approach God only after the offering of blood, they could only be prepared to draw near unto God as blood had been offered to sanctify or to cleanse the conscience. Any question or comment further on that? I think that's important. Okay. Look at verse 24. For Christ entered not into a holy place made with hands, like in pattern to the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear before the face of God for us. This takes us back in the ninth chapter to verse 12, where it says, nor yet through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood entered in once for all into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption. Where did Christ go? Into heaven itself. Now get the picture. He offered the blood on the cross, but then he went into heaven itself before the throne of God as a presentation of his blood, as an offering for the redemption, the eternal redemption that we enjoy in Christ. In verse 25 it says, "Nor yet that he should offer himself often, as the high priest entereth into the holy place year by year, with blood not his own. Else must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world. But now once," let's pause, "once, not multiple times as that Old Testament priest had to do, not with the redundancy that we see identified in verse 11 of the 10th chapter, and every priest indeed standeth day by day ministering and offering oftentimes the same sacrifices, the which can never take away sins. But he, when he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down on the right hand of God." One sacrifice for all time, as opposed to the multiple sacrifices of those Old Testament priests. Now, do you see that some of the themes that we've discussed in the book of Hebrews already tend to cycle? They repeat themselves over and over again. And the writer is drawing a conclusion from all of these things, a very significant conclusion, that what we have is better than what existed under the law. Now, in verse 26, as he continues, "Else must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world. But now once at the end of the ages hath he been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself."
Mickey, all of this plays into Peggy's comments earlier about the finality of the new law.
That's right.
Right? Because we see that he did this once. And we see that in Jude 3, the faith was once and for all delivered to the saints. So we see that not only is it superior, we see the finality of it.
That's right.
It's superior to the point where it happens just once and then that's it for the rest of the time.
That's right. And that becomes a focal point in the book of Hebrews.
And also Romans chapter 6 tells us, for he died in sin, he died in sin once. Everybody really died.
Okay. One sacrifice for all time. Now this sacrifice was made once, it says, at the end of the ages. Some tell us that this is the same as the last days, identified in chapter 1, verse 2. And I think it is. The last days, the end of the ages. Go ahead. I'm waiting. I'm waiting. Some have translated this the climax of history, which I think has some merit on the case. But it identifies a period of time. Now, Terry and I have gone kind of back and forth on the text of Hebrews 1:1-2 regarding the last days, whether it has to do with a period of time just prior to the destruction of Jerusalem or whether it has to do with the last dispensation, the last communication that God has with man through the gospel. And that's why he chuckled as he did, I suppose. But I think the implications here are that Christ would have had to suffer since the foundation of the world, but now he suffers once. And that's the point that needs to be emphasized. He only suffered one time for all time. One time for all time. He's been manifested to put away sin at the conclusion, and I don't doubt that, at the conclusion of the Jewish system, but by the sacrifice of himself one time for all time. Joey? Sin willfully, yeah.
Right, those that sin willfully, there remains no more sacrifice for sin. Again, emphasizing that what Christ did, he did once.
That's right.
To be repeated again. So if you don't take advantage of what he's done, and you're waiting for plan B, there isn't going to be a plan B.
Not going to be a plan B, no. Once for all. Look, if you will, again at verse 27 and 28. It says, "And inasmuch as it is appointed unto men once to die, and after this cometh judgment, so Christ also, having been once offered to bear the sin of many, shall appear a second time apart from sin to them that wait for him unto salvation. Again, emphasize the one sacrifice for all time. Not going to be multiple sacrifices, not going to be anything yet to come. One sacrifice for all time. Now let's talk a little bit more about this as it's appointed unto men once to die. Men die once. Christ offered himself once. Jesus offered himself for sin, but what is this about then cometh the judgment? I want to suggest to you that as Christ offered himself one time to bear the sin of many, as we see in the 28th verse, Isaiah, of course, talking about this in Isaiah chapter 53, verses 4 through 6, and chapter 53, verses 10 through 12. But Jesus came the first time as a sin bearer, to bear the sins of many. Let's turn back to Isaiah chapter 53 and notice a text or two. Beginning at verse 4. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet did we esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, the chastisement of our peace was upon him. Dropping down to verse 10, yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him, and he put him, hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. He shall see all the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied. By the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death, and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. So as we read this Old Testament text, we learn that Christ came the first time as a sin bearer. But what will he do when he comes a second time? That's right. It won't be to do something about sin. It'll be to execute judgment. Okay? Now what about those who have continued to offer those Old Testament sacrifices, and what about those who have now benefited from the sacrifice of Jesus? All right, he'll come for them, those that wait on him, unto salvation. All right, any questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. And he's not going to come as a humble sufferer like he did before. He's going to come in a flaming fire to take vengeance. And that's what a man needs to understand. He's not willing to take that chance that they're taking, you know. Because the second time it says he's coming as they're taking vengeance on those who will not. And he doesn't say anything else, so.
Yeah, not going to be any second chances. When he comes a second time, it's for judgment. That's right. And of course, to reward those that wait on him. Okay? Well, in the 10th chapter, we've talked about the 10th chapter rather extensively before we get to it. But now we're there, and we'll have to talk about it again. In verse 1, for the law having a shadow of the good things to come, not the very image of the things, can never with the same sacrifices, notice the plurality, year by year, which they offer continually, make perfect them that draw nigh. The law could not do. It could not make perfect. In what respect?
Total forgiveness of sins was
all right.
Attainable.
And the fact that it could not forgive sins provided then an affliction or a smiting of the conscience. If you'll see at verse 2. Else would they not have ceased to be offered, because the worshippers, having been once cleansed, would have had no more consciousness of sins.
But in those sacrifices, there is remembrance made of sins year by year. Those Old Testament sacrifices served a purpose. But what purpose did they serve? Remind you of your sin. Now, let's get the picture. Sacrifice after sacrifice, year after year, reminding you of the guilt of your sin. What's that going to do to you? What's the expectation that that would do to you? Pardon me? Not under that system. Jonathan? That's right. Over and over again. Futile.
It would never clear it would never cleanse your conscience either.
No, it would not. And of course that would leave you wanting. Yes, David?
Just a different kind of wording, thinking about cleansing your conscience. You never really had real peace.
Well, the idea of that, I think, is to bring you to something that would give you real peace. And so peace becomes an important word in the New Testament.
Yeah.
Okay. David?
Just like God wanted the people in the wilderness to be dependent on Him, and to see that they needed Him and stuff, the sin offering would bring remembrance that they need God, because they'll never get that forgiveness until God brings about His full plan.
That's right. John? I read one quote of Josephus that said that sometimes these Old Testament priests stood ankle deep in the blood of the animals. And to see the significance of that after year after year after year after year would be quite graphic, I expect. Okay.
John's comment reminds me of the verse of the wages of sin is death. And again, it's just a constant reminder of the terribleness of sin and what the cost and the price is.
That's right.
You know, that they're forced to actually, you know, kill these animals over and over again. And it's just a constant reminder that the penalty for sin is death. It's like, you know, the greatest price that can be paid. And of course, that's leading, these Old Testament scriptures, if we look back with that, hindsight, if you will, and maybe we can see better than they did, perhaps, that this was leading up to the death of Christ.
Exactly.
But at least they understood that the penalty for sin was death. And a constant reminder of how serious sin is.
That's right. In verse 4 it says, it is impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. The blood of the animals couldn't do it, and we repeatedly asked the question, why not? It wasn't the animal that sinned. And so because it wasn't the animal that sinned, killing the senseless animal did not suffice for the sins that man had committed. No, but there was a difference.
His blood did accomplish the redemption.
But he chose.
Yeah, the difference is the will.
But he was the perfect suitable sacrifice that the animals weren't.
Well, that's true, but he willfully offered himself. The senseless animal did not.
Well, that's true.
And as far as the animal was concerned, it was perfect as far as animals go. But it was still the blood of an animal. So it didn't suffice.
The animal doesn't have a choice. Sin involves choice.
Right. That's right. All right, let's look at the quotation from verse 5. Wherefore, when he cometh into the world, he saith, Sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body didst thou prepare for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin thou hadst no pleasure. Then said I, Lo, I am come, in the roll of the book it is written of me, to do thy will, O God. Now the fact that it was not possible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin, there was something had to be provided that was adequate or sufficient to remove sins. And so here we see a quotation from the Old Testament book of Psalms from David, Psalms chapter 40, verse 6. Now this quotation, I think you'll see, is from the Septuagint translation. The Hebrew translation says, instead of a body didst thou prepare for me, I understand it says a body, or rather the ears were opened for me. And that's interesting to me and kind of baffling in some ways, because the expression doesn't seem to be anywhere close to the same. But the purpose of it, I think, is interesting. When you turn back to the book of Exodus, the 21st chapter, and notice in verse 6, the ears of a servant were pierced, as it were, to make a willing and obedient servant, to indicate that this servant belonged unto the master. But when he says, A body dost thou prepare for me, in order for Jesus to come and to offer himself as a sacrifice, he needed to come in some visible form. A body dost thou prepare for me. Now, not just in a visible form, but have something to offer. Now, we've already noted back over in the 5th chapter, reading beginning at verse 1 through about verse 4, that it was necessary for a priest to offer gifts and sacrifices, and it was necessary, therefore, for Jesus to have something to offer. But what did he offer? A body was prepared for him, that he might live in the flesh of man and offer himself as a sacrifice upon the cross. Philippians chapter 2, I think, elaborates on that somewhat in verse 5, beginning, where there it says, Have this mind in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who existing in the form of God, counted not the being on an equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being made in the likeness of men, and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, becoming obedient, even unto death, yea, the death of the cross. Let's pause there in the reading. And notice, if you would please, that Jesus became flesh. He became a man. Now, does that mean he was any less God? No. He was both God and man, God robed in flesh, that he might offer the flesh for a sacrifice upon the cross. David? That's right. Two or three times in John. John 4, 34 and John 6, 38, as well as John 5, verse 30, tells us that he came to do the will of the Father. He subjected himself to his Father all the way through. But now, let's underscore that word subjected himself, or those words. He didn't come with a programmed destiny, as it were. He chose. His will was exercised in his sacrifice. That's right. Okay.